Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 141 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
We are thrilled to be speaking today with professional liar, prevaricator, provocateur, writer, Casey Dyer, to discuss her novel, Finding Fraser. Casey, welcome to the Outlander podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
I know we're here to talk about the book and all about you, but tell us a little bit about what you've been doing recently.
Well, I've literally just stepped off a plane from Iceland. So, I've been away for a month on a research trip. In the course of the trip, I was in England and Wales and Scotland and Iceland. So it was a really exciting time and I got a lot of work done. So I'm very happy to be home in my own bed.
You have a very hard life.
Yeah, it's really tough.
Yeah, Summer was telling me, because the show's on right now, right, on Stars. And
right.
So we have a weekly show once the show is, well, we're always weekly, but when the show's on, we have to be very, very timely. Well, I was in Scotland for a week and a half, and it makes things a little difficult, so.
It does. It really messes with your head. Did it snow while you were there?
You know, it didn't snow. It depended on where I went. Like, when I first got there, I was able to go to the midnight memorial at Culloden, and then the 16th.
Oh, so you were there for the anniversary.
Oh, yes, for the midnight and also for the day.
Oh, lovely.
And it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had an amazing trip there. Culloden is, it's an experience, isn't it?
Oh my goodness. It is. Yeah. I haven't shared anything yet because literally you just stepped off a plane. Well, I kind of just stepped off a plane last Monday and
yeah.
I went back to full-time work the next day and trying to get our shows up, our show that was late and then prepping for the show that goes up tonight and then
right.
prepping
it's crazy.
For your interview, everything.
Yeah.
And so, I videoed 45 minutes of the midnight service, good bits of snippets from the daytime service, and the entire talk by the three historians who were there at Culloden talking about Culloden in the afternoon with permission of the National Trust and also the discussion afterwards. I have all this great audio that I haven't had time to do anything with.
Yeah. Oh, that's so exciting, though. It's really good.
We're excited to share that. But today we're more excited to talk about you and learn about you and your process and what brought us Finding Fraser.
Oh, well, I'm happy to talk about all of it.
I have
many times been to Culloden, and so does Emma in the course of the story of Finding Fraser. Emma Sheridan, who's my main character, she journeys to Culloden, and it is the site of a tragedy for her too, although not of the same epic proportions.
Exactly.
Smaller scale.
Definitely. It's also, well, hers is it's a tragedy for some people there. I mean, obviously the battle, but
right.
on 270-ish years. It's
yes.
a tragedy for others there. Tragedy actually took place at the hostel.
Yes, it's true. But the person that she goes
to
Culloden with is it ends up being more than she thinks that she might be.
Exactly.
Yeah. it was quite an adventure. So, but that's not really the place where we should start, I suppose.
Oh no, we want to start with you actually. How long have you been writing, and or when did you catch the writing bug, as it were?
You know, I've been writing forever. It's just so technically I have been published as a published author. My first book was published, I can't actually remember if it was 2001 or 2002, but quite a while ago. I've had six books published since then before Finding Fraser, and then Fraser came out. So it's my lucky number seven. Oh man, it really has been. This book has been the best experience of my career. It's been so much fun. But before I was writing books, I produced a newspaper in the little village I live in. I was writing freelance for local newspapers locally and internationally. And so I knew how to put a sentence together before I wrote my first book. But I'd never had the experience of having a book produced before, just around the turn of the century.
The turn of the millennium. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Even more exciting. Yeah.
I know. So before you started writing, or as you wrote, even before you were published, what did you study in college? What were your early interests?
Okay, well, I was trained as a teacher. So I was a teacher for a couple of years before I had kids. And so really, you know what? My biggest interest is I should have a PhD in bookworm. That's my greatest skill, is being a reader, which means that now that I've been a writer for so long, my employability has drastically dropped in other fields.
So basically, you better keep churning them out, because this is your life now.
This is it. This is all I can do. Actually, what I do in addition to the writing is that I do work with other writers. Because most of my books, I've written for teens. I write for teens and adults, but I've written a lot of YA novels. And so when you're a Canadian writer who writes for teens, in order to make a living, you have to go out and visit schools and teach classes and, you know, do all those things that you need to do to keep body and soul together as a writer. And so one of the things that I do both in that forum and also in under the auspices of the Surrey Writers Conference is work with other writers, you know, and help them through the process and, you know, talk about what it takes to get yourself published and all that sort of thing, all the attendant information that you need to know. This is a very complicated, people think that, you know, writing a book is something that you do in your spare time. And you know, perhaps some people have done that, but it's a complicated field. And this industry is an interesting one to work in. So it's always nice to have someone who can hold your hand through it and help you out.
You mentioned the Surrey Writers Conference. Isn't that one that Diana attends?
Yes. So Diana and I have worked together at the Surrey Writers Conference this year is going to be our 24th year. I think she started the second year that it was going. She came to the conference. So definitely more than 20 years. I started coming probably about 98 or 99. So we've been working together for definitely more than 15 years. We work together on the contest. There's a writing contest every year that Diana is one of the judges for. And she and I have worked together under those auspices. And, you know, we've just been friends for a long time. We knew each other online before we met in person, though, because we were both members of the CompuServe Writers Forum. And we both still are members of the CompuServe Readers and Writers Forum, or Books and Writers Forum, I guess it's called now. But anyway, yeah, that was when I first moved to the house that I live in now, the only way I could get internet was through CompuServe. And that was when I was starting to think that I might like to write a book. And I found this little writers forum where other writers hung out online. And it was really cool because I had little kids, and so I couldn't really get to meetings and things like that. So it was a good place for me to connect with other writers online. And one of the other writers I connected with was Diana.
You probably connected with Diana just as, or just before Summer first found Outlander, right?
Oh, so when did you start reading it, Summer?
Well, I started reading the fourth book.
that's right. Funny. How that happened. So the fourth book came out, you found it in the bookstore, and you started it not knowing anything about the series.
Pretty much. And well, I realized pretty early on that I was missing something. But I wasn't exactly sure what that was. But I finished it anyway. And Diana has a way of writing in a way that you have all the backstory you need to kind of get enough to understand moving forward. So I didn't need any of the other books to understand what was happening. But there was definitely a lot lost.
Right.
By not having read the first three. So I went back and read the first three and filled in the gaps and then just never looked back.
So that would have been her fourth, like the first book came out, I think around 92.
I think I read the fourth book in like 98.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, so that would have been about the time that I was connecting with the CompuServe Writers Forum.
Were you familiar with her books before you?
No. And so I was just trying to meet other writers there always have been, and there continue to be, widely published writers who hang out at this forum. You know, most of them just drop in now and again, but Diana's, she was a SysOp, which is, you know, a systems operator. She ran several of the different, forums within the writers forum, several of the different pages. And so I, this is where I first heard about her book. And so I started reading it. So that would have been in the late 90s. But I'm thinking, I'm surprised to hear you say, because I feel like I, when I started reading it, only the third book was out, because it was lucky, because I felt so lucky because I could charge through these three amazing books. But I don't think the fourth book had been published yet. So it was around about that time anyway.
When you went online and discovered the Writers Forum and were connecting with other writers, this was as you were beginning to think you might want to write?
Yeah, well, I had been writing already. So my kids were born in 90 and 92. And so since I'd been home with them, I'd been writing. But I hadn't had anything published. I'd had quite a few rejection letters, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then when I went on to the forum, so it would have been, I think, probably 96 or 97. I moved here in 95. So I think 96, I went on to the forum. And that's when I first heard about this writer's conference. And I thought, oh, you know, one day when my children are older, I can take off and I could go to something like that, because I thought it was in Surrey, England.
Yeah.
But it turned out it was in Surrey, British Columbia, which is essentially in my own backyard. And so it was the first thing that I ever went to where I left my kids alone with their dad. And so that was, you know, I think 98 when I went to the conference first. And so I'd been writing on the forum for a while by then. And so I knew of Diana. I'd read all her books to that point. And so I was excited to meet her in person. It was really wonderful. And it was there that I learned, I didn't understand what an amazing influence she is on other writers' lives. And I think it's something that doesn't really get noticed in the greater scheme of things, because, you know, this is our own little world. The writing world is pretty incestuous. Lots of, I know, you know, all my friends are writers, and you know, we all know each other. Obviously not everybody, but you know, it's a fairly small community, and have always been so thrilled with Diana's interest in helping other writers. She's very warm and very sharing. And I think that is evidenced by her work on the Writers Forum, because it's a great place to go and ask other writers questions. You know, if you're stuck about something, just how long does daylight last in Reykjavik on a March evening? You could post that on the forum, and someone who's there will know. They'll look it up for you, or they'll have been there, or they can give you some insight. And Diana's definitely one of the leaders in helping other writers in that environment. So we've always had a really great relationship. She's always been wonderfully supportive of me as a writer and of other writers that are around me. And it's really great. She comes to this conference that I've been on the board of directors now for more than a decade. And you know, Diana's one of our regulars, because when she comes, she sets the tone. She sets the tone for writers helping other writers. And that's very special.
It's a way of giving back.
It totally is. It totally is. But you know what else? It is very interesting is that there is a percentage of people out there who decide that they want to write a book and make $1 million and have a bestseller, and that, you know, they feel that that all, it, you know, can happen if they put some attention to it with some fair ease. I think that sometimes that interest in celebrity or in becoming famous overtakes the joy in just creating. And so I have actually been to many events that where writers don't have that same collegial spirit. And that spirit of giving back, that collegiality of helping one another, is something that really sets the Surrey Writers Conference apart. And it's Diana's a big part of that.
So I would take from that, if someone is interested in going to a conference that has a very, very talented and well-known and well-spoken, well-written authors, writers, also a very supportive atmosphere, that would be
absolutely
a good one to go to.
Yeah, definitely. And I can give you the link for that later if people want to look it up online.
Great.
Yeah, it's held every October.
In general, we have a few questions about your process.
Sure.
How long does it take you to create your work from inception to publish?
Well, you know, it really depends. It depends on the book. I've had books that I have, I wrote a book called Miss Zephyr's Notebook, which took me about 9 months to get that thing written and out there and in the world. And now at that time, I was already an established writer. And so when I presented the idea to my publishing house, I didn't have to go through the whole process of, you know, finding an agent and that sort of thing. So that was probably the fastest. The slowest is the one that I'm working on right now. And I started this project in 2006. I really, really hope I finish it this year because 10 years is long enough. But it'll be 5 books when it's done. And it's a huge epic story that is this 1,000-year time span. And it's been a really, really big project. One of the stories is set in Iceland, which is why I was off on my research trip. It really varies. I wrote Finding Fraser as a break from this big project that I was working on because I couldn't get, at the time, my agent didn't like the main character and I couldn't get any interest in the first book. And I was feeling very down and I really needed something to make myself laugh. And I had the idea for Finding Fraser and I told my writing partner about it and she laughed. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I can work on that as a back burner project. And so that's essentially what I did. Yeah. So it took me about a year to write.
To write Finding Fraser?
Yeah.
So when you're writing, or I guess even when you're not writing, I guess as a writer, even if you're not having one thing with a steady goal, like I want it, like you do now, you want to get this finished by this year.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever you're working on.
That's more panic than anything else.
What is your typical daily schedule? How do you have routine? A lot of writers have routine.
Yeah. No, I'm terrible. don't use me as an example. Please don't ever use me as an example because I don't write to an outline. I don't write to a routine. I write as much as I can, as often as I can. See, the problem is, it depends on what else is going on. Even within the realm, I'm a full-time writer. This is all I do. I mean, apart from, nipping out and teaching a workshop now and again, I write for a living. And so I need to work on it all the time. And essentially that's what I do. I mean, I'm often writing late into the night. My best writing time is not first thing in the morning. I know some writers, they sit down with their cup of coffee and they get to it right away first thing in the morning. And I don't do that. I have to go for a run or take my dog for a walk or something first thing in the morning because my brain is like not functioning at that hour of the day. But I work really well at the other end of the day. My first 3 books I wrote entirely after midnight because my kids were small.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
When you are working or thinking about working, do you have any ritual, anything you do that helps guide you or ground you or make you comfortable so you can get into that space?
I think I'm really good because my writing career coincided with staying at home with my kids. And so I'm really good at, I don't need to have a quiet space and it doesn't need to be a certain time of day. I just try to take whatever opportunity I can to write. I think about it a lot. I think about it before I go to sleep. I think, when I'm walking my dog is just fantastic because I live on the side of a mountain. So I hike up the mountain every day with him. And that's really good because, the oxygen gets flowing and the ideas get going. And I often bring I have my phone with me in case I fall off the mountain so I can, let someone know. And so you would not believe the number of notes I have taken on my phone from, I just get this idea while I'm climbing across a log. And so, thank goodness for iPhones.
So you just spoke a little bit about your latest research trip. So you, not just for purposes of research for your writing, for your work, you seem to travel a lot.
Yeah, I love traveling, but it is all for my work. It's all for my work. So, I've been to Scotland. Well, my daughter lives in Scotland now. And so, and that's my fault because when my very first book was set in Scotland and I had, I needed to have a castle that was on a tidal lock. So I needed to find a place where the tide came in and cut the castle off for the story. And I really wanted my story to be, my stories tend to be, not all of them. Some of them are contemporary, but mostly they're historical fiction. And in this story, there was an historical component and I needed a 14th century castle. And so I took my kids to Scotland to see if I could find one. And I did. So I've taken them back several times as they were growing up. And now she's there going to university. So.
Which university is she going to?
She's going to the University of Edinburgh.
Oh, very nice. I was at St. Andrews.
Oh, were you? Oh, yeah. Her flatmate last year
her sister was going to St. Andrews. And so that's what an amazing university that is.
Oh, it is. It's yeah.
So it's beautiful.
So absolutely. Surrounded by medieval ruins. I mean, on the sea, no less.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite beautiful.
Oh, I've totally been to St. Andrews. It's there. It's just lovely. So, yeah. So I can see where your love of Outlander springs from then. There's a certain, you know, my family's from Scotland, and there's a certain very magical quality about the place. And so it's, for me, I've had several of my books that have been set there. So yeah, for me, traveling there has just been fantastic, because then I can go and learn. Every time I go, I learn something new.
So you've mentioned how you found the Writers Forum, and then you found Diana, and then you found out about Outlander.
I think that's, you know, it's so long ago, it's hard to know if that's the way that it worked, but I think so. The problem is that I'm such an avid reader, and I'm sure you totally understand this. You know, sometimes it's hard to know where you found the book. And also, the problem that I have is that when I, let me just give you an example. I had never read Jane Austen. It was one of those, she was one of those authors that had passed me by. And one of the times I was visiting the UK, I picked up a Bridget Jones book, and I just loved Bridget Jones. I thought she was, you know, it was so funny and such a cool thing, but I didn't get the whole Mr. Darcy connection. Right. And I thought, you know, I've got to read me some Pride and Prejudice. And so of course, as soon as I finished reading the Bridget Jones, I leapt into Jane Austen and read everything that she wrote in her all too short life, and loved it. Of course, just loved all of the Jane Austen. But the problem is that I read it all at once. And so sometimes I get my plot lines mixed up in my head. Was that from Sense and Sensibility, or was that from Emma, or, you know, so this happens, you know, when you're an avid reader, you just devour everything that you find by an author that you like. And so I feel the same about Diana. I'm not actually sure when I started reading her book, but it was around about that time.
So what do you like to read? Obviously, you probably like to read historical fiction, since you are a fan of that and create that.
The historical parts of my fiction, I write a lot of time travel stories too. And so that also was an appeal of Diana's book, because the story that I was working on when I first read her books was this story that was time travel story. And so we had that in common. And let me tell you, it is so brutally difficult to sell time travel stories. I would advise people never to try to write them, because they don't fit into any categories, and people, you know, it's really a tough sell. So I like to read everything. I am a very eclectic reader. Right now I'm reading a book by Robert Galbraith called The Cuckoo's Calling. So if you are familiar with Robert Galbraith, you'll know that he is the alter ego of J.K. Rowling. Ah. And so I bought this book when I was in London a few days ago, because I had just, when I met up with my daughter in the UK, she came, I caught my flight back from Iceland to Glasgow, and then I picked her up on the train, and she came down to London with me, and we went to the Harry Potter studios, and I was expecting that it would be very commercial, but I actually just loved it. We had such a good time. And afterwards I thought, oh, what can I read of J.K. Rowling's that I haven't read yet? So I picked up this book. So that's a mystery novel. It's a contemporary mystery. Other books that I read biography, I read nonfiction, tons of science books. I'm very, very into anything written by Mary Roach. I love travel books, Bill Bryson. I'm a huge reader of all genres.
One of your characters in Finding Fraser in the beginning, well, I guess she comes up a few times, but she's in the Philadelphia group, and right. She talks about, she gets upset when Emma does not justify the fact that this is a legitimate style of book. Like, this is its own genre. Scottish right. time travel is
Scottish
its own
time
genre.
Travel. I actually had someone say that to me, so that's how that found its way into the book. And I was like, what?
Well, but then I thought about it. I thought about it a little more afterwards, and I was like, you know, I have read a lot of time travel books, and almost all of them were Scottish. So
it's funny.
There has to be a legit
Okay, theme. But you know what? If there is, then the mother of that genre is Diana.
Oh, I would.
Yeah, so definitely. But you know, Dorothy Dunnett is a huge historical fiction, author, and there's so many brilliant writers out there that, you know, I mean, too many books, not enough time, right?
Oh, that's the story of my life. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like bread. I like carbs. I like cheese. But my weakness is a bookstore or a library.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And if they sell hot chocolate too, I mean, how that is like perfection.
Well, yeah. Like Barnes & Noble, as soon as they added Starbucks to them, yeah. It's done.
Yeah. You know what? I actually think they got that from the UK. Because about it, like when you were in Scotland, everywhere you go, there's all the Waterstones books, bookstores have their own tea shop. And mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So
how and when, speaking of Emma and Emma Sheridan and her adventures, and when did you first get the idea? Now, you mentioned writing it was a break from your current project.
Yeah.
But when did you actually, that's when and why you did it. When did the idea of the story come to you for Finding Fraser?
Okay, so you know what? These things happen in different ways. Lots and lots of times when I'm writing a book, I get the glimmer of a story. And then I sort of, when I work on it a little bit, I can sort of see perhaps where I'm going. But I have no idea how I'm going to get there. With Finding Fraser, the story came to me. I was in the shower one morning and the story came to me fully formed, but I didn't know what was going to happen with Emma. I didn't know what would happen on her adventures, but the idea of someone who's in love with a character from a book, I think anyone who's an avid reader can relate to that idea. And I was shampooing my hair and I thought, what if, you know, I was thinking of all the books that I love and I thought, what if someone fell in love with Jamie Fraser and then decided they were going to go try and find him. And that was the most fully formed an idea I've ever had for a book. So I thought, well, that would be pretty funny, actually. You know, I'd have to make sure that she was in a state of pretty much desperation before she started to take on such a crazy adventure. But I thought, you know, maybe I'll give it a try. And you know, then I literally dried my hair and went into town. Once or twice a week, I meet with some friends who are writers. And one of my friends who I write with every week, I told her the idea and she laughed. She's friends with Diana too. She also works as a matter of fact, her name is Kathy Chung. She's the conference coordinator for the Surrey Writers Conference. Anyway, I told her the idea and she laughed and she said, you got to write that. And so I did.
Well, and what's funny is that this actually happens. Like this isn't.
tell her
this isn't like.
It does happen. But you know what? I did not know that before I wrote the book. It wasn't until I wrote the book that I started to see all the times that this actually happens.
Even if, I mean, I'm sure it happens like for soloists as well as duets, like my sister and I. Although we traveled with another friend once we got to Scotland last year. I, going on my own this year, Summer and I traveling together last year, it was so funny because even if, obviously, we weren't doing the exact same trail that Emma was
on, right.
But getting, I mean, every single place we went, yes, we're American, yes, we stick out, but I mean, at Black Ness, anywhere we went, and there wasn't a huge crowd, because we try to stay away from, like, the huge crowds of American tourists,
right.
But even on our own, people would say, obviously, you're American, are you here looking for Jamie, or something, it was just... Wherever we went, it was Outlander thing.
Right. Okay, so that's kind of interesting because when I actually wrote this book 3 years ago. So it's just, you know, it's taken, these things take time. And this one has had a really interesting route to being, you know, to this new launch that's happening with Berkeley this week. I wrote the book, I finished it like nearly 3 years ago. At that time, there was no idea of a television show in sight. It was just the idea of the books, and so Emma could quite rightly just fall for the character in the book because there was no Sam Heughan or any of the Outlander show on TV. then I had to go back since then. And, you know, that's been one of the things that I've had to edit into the book, was the fact that this TV show exists. And I still think, you know, Emma is still a purist. So I think that even with how great the show is, I think she'd still stick to her guns and just, you know, she loves her Jamie from the book.
Well, even before the series came out, there was people going over there looking for standing stone circles.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So it was very amazing. Like the amount of people like standing in line, like if you happened to catch up with a tour bus,
yeah,
you maybe weren't on, but you happened to catch up and hit one of the Clava Cairns or something like that at the exact same time as a tour bus. There's a line of people standing and waiting turns to take a picture.
Touching the stones. I know. It's too funny, eh? Well, the book's been out since 92. So, you know, this story has captured, you know, the imagination of readers everywhere. And that's what happened to Emma. And so I just wanted to explore the idea of what happens to someone who falls so hard for a character in a book that she's willing to give up everything and see if she can find the real life counterpart. I thought that was a neat idea. And I thought that it was transferable. It worked for me to use Jamie because he's such a quintessential hero, isn't he? He's willing to, you know, once he has fallen for Claire, he's willing to do anything for her. He will, and he's a thinking man, he's an educated man, and he's, you know, he's just such a stand-up, good-looking guy, that he was sort of a perfect example of someone that Emma, who's, you know, got a very huge streak of desperation running through her, would, you know, why can't she find a man like that? Why can't she do it? So she decides she wants to go and look for him. And to me, the beauty of this story, the enjoyment of the story, comes from the fact that while she goes on all these adventures, what she ends up with is not exactly what she expected when she left.
And one of the things that Emma does, whether they are truly the people they come across to be or not, is she meets people from outside of Scotland. She meets Americans, she meets Irish people, she meets Scots, she meets many different people. And so one of the things I always find interesting, in whether it's in your book, in Diana's books, in any book, quite frankly, that uses not just someone from a different culture or a different country as a character in place, but when there's dialogue that is transcribing an accent into English. I'm also a linguist. As a linguist and a book reader, I'm always interested in finding out how you or how authors decide to transcribe an accent onto paper or into electrons. Did you listen to various accents or find a good source or writer whose work you liked and could follow?
Yeah, all of the above. Also, I have to say one of my other dear friends, his name is Jack White, who is a Scotsman. He's a transplanted Scotsman. He lives here. He wrote me a very nice blurb for the book too when it came out, which was lovely. And I'll just say that if you look at the Gaelic translation of Finlay, that it might translate to white warrior. Anyway, Jack, who's a lovely man, at one of his workshops years ago, and he was talking about writing dialect. And he said one of the things that I have always really paid attention to, and he said, if you want something to sound like it was written as a period piece, then use formal English. Take out the contractions. Make your English as formal as possible, because that gives it a universality that allows it to fit into a period of time. And if you're going to use dialect, use it as sparingly as possible. And I really strongly agree with that. I mean, obviously there's a, you know, I use a few in my own writing to indicate various people's backgrounds. I use a smattering of dialect here and there, and I try to be consistent with it, so that the character elides one particular phrase, then that's consistent throughout their appearances in the book. But I think that you can really, really drown your readers in over ach lassie. and so you just have to be really careful to have a gentle touch. So one of the things I did was I talked to my daughter's boyfriend, who's a born Scotsman, and he really helped me with some of the dialect in this book and in another book that I'm working on, to make sure that the contemporary usages were there, because I think that we're inclined to think, oh, Scottish, they're going to call everyone laddie and lassie. And you know what? That just doesn't happen. So trying to get contemporary usages and not overused dialect is really, really important to me. I pride myself on making the dialect in my books flow really smoothly, and that's something that I work really hard on.
I know from doing transcribing standard English, if you will, standard American English back from my graduate school days, that it's a pain just to to understand the average person or different people speaking, quote unquote, the same dialect that right. That is actually my dialect. So that should be the easiest, right?
Yeah.
But then there's challenges to that. And then you enter foreign language or a dialect of your own language. I mean, it can be a challenge. So, you know, hats off to you, because that was, it interrupted the flow only because it was different.
Right.
But you're in the story, and it didn't stop and make you go, oh, I just can't. I can't go forward. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It didn't stop you and take you out of the story, halted you because it was different.
Well, I think it's like it's supposed to catch your eye as an identifier for the character. And so, but you know, you have to do that with all your characters, because you should be able to write unattributed dialogue, and your readers should be able to understand speaking by virtue of the way that they speak. We all have our own little vocal tics and identifiers, and that should come through. A good writer can, you know, should be able to do that in their story, weave that through. It is a bit tougher when you're writing. It's also, you have to be very judicious in your use of it. You know, once again, because I know that for an American audience, I don't want to have them tripping over every time somebody says yeah instead of you. And so I, you know, you have to be judicious in your use of it. I like to hope that it reads as smoothly as possible anyway.
It read very smoothly.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah, of course. As some of the promotional materials that were sent to us, you're quoted as saying, "It's okay to be crazy. We walk through this world only once, and maybe following our dreams is not always the wrong thing to do." So we started our podcast on a whim. It's been a crazy whim, and we still have day jobs, and it's brought us amazing friends and experiences and opportunities. And have you ever had people tell you that they feel like they are their own Emmas as well?
Oh, all the time. All the time. You would not believe the number of... I actually have the website findingfraser.com, which Emma creates in the story. I built one for her. I did that so that there would be a place that that people could go in case they thought, oh, I wonder if this really is a thing. Then they could go and they can see some of the pictures that Emma's put up from her travels. And one of the things that I put on to that site was a page called Fraser Found, where people tell their stories of their own love stories of finding their Fraser. And some of them are people who have, you know, gone off on an adventure and had a very happy ending to it. Not all of them. There's lots of those stories that are just people who have found a deep love that they feel like is reflective of the love that Claire and Jamie share. And so they want to share that with me too. But I love hearing those stories. I love it. And I love reading the stories of people who throw caution to the winds and go out and take on something that they've never done before. That's you know, how lucky are we that we live in a world where we can do that? And if that opportunity presents itself, I'm always the first person to say, go do it. It's life's too short not to give it a try.
Do you have your own Emma story?
Well, lots of the stories from this book, lots of the episodes happened in one way or another to me while I was on various trips and you know, as a writer, you use all kinds of things from your life to inform your stories. I think that that's a big danger that writers face, because they feel like they should be, you know, sitting alone in a garret writing about what they know. And I think that it's always really important to get out there and have the adventures happen to you. One time, my son and I were in Stirling, and we hopped in a cab because in all the times I'd been to Stirling, I'd never gone to the Wallace Monument. And you'll note that there is a scene where Emma that takes place where Emma is captured by the police actually outside the Wallace Monument. Yeah, there's a goat in that scene that watches her implacably, and I met that goat. but on the way to the monument, the cab driver who he had, I'm very good with accents. I would actually say I'm excellent with accents, but this guy had the thickest Glaswegian accent that I had ever heard. And my son he was about 16 at the time, and he just looked at me with blank eyes. He had no idea what this man was saying. But what the man was telling me was he was telling me about his experience with when the movie Braveheart had been shot, and that he'd been among the people who'd been living in Inverness at the time. And they, you know, had obviously done a lot of location shooting. And anyway, he was telling me this long story about how the star of that particular show, who was also an executive producer, they when they did the big launch of the movie, rode to the location of the movie premiere in a limousine with black windows and did not come out to even say thank you to the people of Inverness. And he was really mad, this cab driver. And he just wanted to just tell me the whole story. And I think it was because he'd heard my accent. Now, I'm actually Canadian, but the assumption is whenever I'm anywhere that I'm American. So I think that he assumed that because I had what he thought was an American accent, he wanted to tell me about this American actor who had done them wrong, you know. And so that his rant made its way straight into the page of this book. You know, it was a different character who was telling the story, and the story was changed somewhat. But yeah, there's a lot of things that have informed Emma and her adventures, for sure.
As you said, many of the things that have ended up in Finding Fraser that Emma goes through or observes or experiences are from events or experiences that you've had.
Yeah, but not all of them. Like, a lot of it I've just made up out of the whole cloth.
But have you had your own Emma story? Have you ever taken your own risks?
Oh, I see. Okay. No.
You're honest. That's good.
Well, you know why, though? You know why? I don't have to.
That's true, because it's in your brain.
And it's because this is what I do. I make things up for a living. And in order to make things up, I go off on adventures by myself all the time. Have I gone to chase my own Fraser? I have never done that. I'm not looking for a Fraser. But Emma was, and I wanted to make her experience as authentic as possible. And so I did use some of the adventures that have happened to me. Rabbi the gnome has he was definitely an adventure that happened. So but have I gone off to find my own Fraser? No, I haven't done that. Instead, I wrote about Emma.
Some of the adventures that Emma has, you made up, and some are based on things that you've been through, as we said.
Yeah.
Are there things that you considered putting in that you decided maybe not to put in that you could share with us?
Well, let me tell you, because I'm very much a part of this community of people who are fans of the Outlander series, and I see them all the time. These fans come every year, wherever Diana is, you know, she's surrounded by a group of people who just love what she does. And you know, they want to tell her that and you know, show her how much they appreciate her and that sort of thing. And I had to tone back a lot of the material that I had in my first draft because I thought, well, first of all, it has to be believable, right? and fiction has to be believable. And sometimes real life is just so bizarre. You just can't even. Yeah. But for the most part, the people that surround Diana are such an enthusiastic fan base, like just an amazingly enthusiastic fan base. And so, so for the part of Emma's journey through the U.S., she gets to interact with that fan base a little bit, both from the Romance Writers Convention, and then she goes to a fan fiction event. And have you guys ever been to a fan fiction event?
No, I have not.
No, only to Comic-Con.
Yeah. Well, Comic-Con's like, it's kind of like a big version of that. So, you know, you get an idea of the wild enthusiasm that people hold for whatever it is, whatever work that it is that they love, whether it's, you know, Firefly or Star Trek or Outlander. And some of the fans can be pretty wild and crazy. And, yeah, so, I, I would really advise you to go, because it's that would be very, I think that would broaden your perspective on the Outlander fan base too, because there's some really enthusiastic fans out there.
See, now my interpretation of fan fiction usually, and this is just because it's the only kind of experiences I've had with it at all, are people writing using the characters that already exist and then basically making them have sex with each other. That's what I think fan fiction is. And I could be totally wrong.
Slash fiction, you know, that's slash fan fiction, right? I think that, you know, who's going to hook up with who and who you're shipping to go with characters that doesn't happen in their world. It was really very, very important to me. I mean, as a writer, that's not something that I do. And that comes purely out of snobbery from my own perspective, because I create my own characters. And I don't want to take on somebody else's characters and write stories about them. That's not something that appeals to me. I know, however, that it appeals to millions of people. And so it's a huge thing. And, you know, fine, go for it. But particularly in this case, so, you know, when I wrote this story, I did not tell Diana I was writing the story. I didn't, you know, when you're writing a book, you start from scratch. You don't know if it's going to turn into anything. You don't know what's going to happen. It took me about a year to write this book. And just out of coincidence, I finished the book on Valentine's Day at about 2 a.m. I finished my first draft. And so I, you know, something happens to you when you write in the middle of the night. You get a little crazy. And I had post-manuscript euphoria. And so I just was feeling so excited and so thrilled. And I thought, I'm going to have to tell her sometime. So I'm going to just send it to her right now. And this was such a huge mistake. I just cannot emphasize how important it is that you never send a first draft off to anyone, really, because I hadn't even spell checked it yet. But I thought, I need her to know that I wrote this book. And so it's not fan fiction. Because Diana does not like fan fiction. She has a statement on the very front page of her website. She's created these characters. She doesn't like it when other people take them and take characters that she has created in her world and put them into other worlds. And I wanted her to know, in the depths of my crazy, in the middle of the night, that I'd written a book about a fan, but that it was not fan fiction. And I wanted her to be really clear on that, because it's something that I know that she doesn't personally approve of, but it's also something that I would never have done anyway, regardless of her, you know, even if she was very open to that sort of thing. And so, anyway, I did the dumb thing, and I sent the book off to her in the middle of the night with a big long letter all about, you know, confessing to her what I had done. I also didn't want her to, you know, I wanted to know if she really didn't like the book, or she hated it, or she felt in any way it would reflect badly on her stories. I didn't want to, you know, do anything with it, because I thought that wasn't my purpose. This is a story about someone who deeply loves the Outlander universe. And so I wanted to make sure that the person I was writing about wasn't offended by that. And so I was really lucky because she did like the story, and she has been really supportive ever since.
So your post-manuscript euphoria is a lot like a successful drunk dialing.
That is exactly what it's like. And do you know how you feel the next morning when you've done that, when you've drunk tweeted and... and you wake up the next morning and you think, oh no.
What have I done?
That is exactly what, and I woke up and it was, you know, I had finished writing the book at, let's say, 10 after 2. I wrote her this long letter, and it was a long letter. So I didn't finish that. I don't think I sent it off to her till 3:30 or 3:45, right? And then I crashed. And then, of course, I had to wake up the next morning to get my kids to school. And so I'm lying in bed trying to force myself out of bed at 7:30 in the morning. And then the memory returns. And I'm just horrified. I'm just horrified at the thought of it. And then, in fact, so I opened my email because I thought, that's it. I'm dead. I'm just dead. I've, you know, because she's my friend and I don't want to hurt her feelings. And I don't want to do something that is disappointing. And I just felt sick about it. I was like sick. And I opened and she'd sent me this lovely email already first thing in the morning, obviously when she'd received the letter the night before. And she hadn't read the book, but she said, you know, it's you. I trust you, and it's going to be okay. So she basically talked me off the ledge. So, which was really nice. And then in fact, and then she said she would read it and let me know. And of course, you know, it wasn't a good time for her. It's like a million things going on. And so she, when she got back to me a couple of weeks later and said that she was really enjoying it, that she'd had to put it away because it was interfering with her, because she wanted to, she was working at that time. She needed to not be engaged in the story. And so it was really good. It turned out all right in the end, but you're right. It was exactly that huge amount of regret was awful.
Well, it's not just that you did what you did, right? It was that it was a friend.
Yeah.
It's so worse. It's a person you're going to see again and work with. And
right. And so it's like sending that tweet off to like a coworker, you know, or a close friend that you just, if you send them, because it was a love letter. I sent her a 100,000 word letter. I mean, that's what Finding Fraser is. It's a love letter to Scotland and it's Emma's love letter to Outlander. And so, you know, there's a certain level of vulnerability to that. And, you know, you asked me earlier if I ever did Emma things. Like, well, that was an Emma thing. That was a really...
you're right.
And I wish the next morning I wish that I hadn't. But ever since then, you know what? It has just been fantastic. This has been the most fun ever because this is a book that is really written with love and it has been surrounded by love. I've only worked with people that I know and love. I've only written the story about people that I love. And, you know, the writing experience, the publishing world is not really filled with love as a rule. And so I feel really very lucky.
So as we close, one of the things that you say is that Finding Fraser is an homage, really, about a fervent reader in love with the great book.
Yes.
And that comes off of every page.
Oh, good.
And before we finish up, you've talked about the book you're working on right now and hope to finish this year. Is there anything else besides being head or eyeball deep in what you're doing now? And of course, promotion and media for the upcoming release this week. Are there projects like little kernels in your mind or in your heart, on your brain that you see of the next story or the next story or the next story?
Well, you know, I never say never. If there's an interest in finding out what happens with Emma at the end of Finding Fraser, I would not be averse to writing another story about her and the characters around her. I love the people that came out of this book. I think I had so much fun with Morag. So much fun. I actually have, I'm going to do a signing with Diana at the Poison Pen next week on Thursday. And that's really the official launch of the book. Mm. And that's going to be a ton of fun. But then I have to come home back to Vancouver. And then on Saturday night, I'm doing a fundraising event, which is where a group of writers are going to toast a selection of Scotch whiskeys. And so they've asked me to read a scene from Finding Fraser at that event. And I'm going to read the scene where Morag makes butter with Emma. And Morag thinks about her own love life when she's giving advice to Emma. And I love that scene. I had so much fun. I still can't read that scene without laughing out loud. Because so the characters are very... You know, I'm crazy. I'm a writer. They're very real to me. And I would love to dip back into this world. Is it going to happen? I don't know for sure, but I'm not saying no.
I would like Morag to be real. And I would like to go stay at her place for 6 months. I'll pull a goat out of another goat. That's cool.
Those were sheep, I'll have you know. They were sheep.
Oh my God. They were sheep.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this has been a delight. And we can't wait to, if you choose to go that direction, we can't wait to find out more about Emma, but also the book you're working on now and other projects. We're excited to continue to follow you and find out what the next journeys and exciting thrills are.
Oh, thank you so much. That's lovely to hear.
Obviously, here today, we're talking about yourself and Finding Fraser specifically, but if someone wanted to get a hold of you or contact you, what are some of the best outlets to do so?
Okay, well, I have my website, which is caseydyer.com. If they want to find out more about Emma, you can look at the findingfraser.com website as well. I hang out on Twitter mostly. That's my favorite location. So I'm there as Casey Dyer. I'm also on Facebook. And I do Instagram as well. Instagram is more, it's more me walking in the woods with my dog. So you can have an idea of what it's like to live in the rainforest on the side of a mountain in British Columbia if you look at my Instagram. But if people want to find me, that the best place to find me is on Twitter, I think, at Casey Dyer. And I don't follow everybody because I can't, but I answer everyone who emails me or texts me. And you know what, we talked about this at the beginning, but I do work with other writers. And, you know, so if somebody has a question about getting a book published or something that they're interested in, they want to find out more about the Surrey Writers Conference. Oh, that, I can give you the website for that as well, which is siwc.ca. So that stands for Surrey International Writers Conference, .ca. So those are all places where you can find me.
Excellent. Well, we hope maybe, because even though this is directly Outlander related, we hope maybe once your new book is out, perhaps to have you back, because now that you've been here and you're the only Casey Dyer out there, you have an Outlander connection forever. And
that's
so
right.
We'd it's, love it's, to it's, be able to help you out, chat about your next book once that's ready.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very generous of you.
So thank you so much for joining us today. It was our pleasure to have you here, and we can't wait to see how this launch goes, and best of luck in the coming months.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.